WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
Before we start Season 2, Episode 1 of Bolts of the Nation, I just want to say I've heard about the devastating natural disasters, what with the earthquake in Morocco and Algeria, plus the devastating floods in Libya, which have killed thousands. It's an absolutely devastating event for North Africa. If y'all want to donate to some of the relief funds, there will be links in the description below on the podcast website and as well on the Instagram account. We're thinking of the people who have been affected, the millions of people whose lives have been forever altered because of this disaster, and we hope that the recovery will be as quick as possible. Hello, everybody, and we are back for Season 2 of Pulse of the Nation. I am your host, Braden Vick, and before we start off with the flashback, I want to give y'all a little bit of breaking news. Senator Mitt Romney, the Republican from Utah. If even you have a passing notion of politics, you will have heard this man's name. He was the Republican Party's nominee for president in 2012 when he lost a pretty competitive election to then-incumbent President Barack Obama. And before that, he was governor of Massachusetts. He comes from a political dynasty. His father, George Romney, was the governor of Michigan, I believe. And Mitt himself has been in politics for a very, very long time. In 2018, Romney became a United States Senator from the state of Utah, where he is now based. And just a couple of hours before recording started, he announced that he is not running for re-election in 2024, as it is likely that the 76-year-old's political career is going to be over. And this seems to me more like a symbolic ending of sorts, you know, the past era of Republican politics, as Mitt Romney was thought of as one of the more moderate Republican senators, although still very conservative, especially on economic issues and China. But he has been one of the most active anti-Trump voices within the Republican Party. And whoever wins that Utah Senate primary, unless it's Governor Spencer Cox, is likely going to be more amenable to the politics of presumptive GOP nominee and former President Donald Trump. So I wanted to get that out of the way before we start off our flashback. The last time I recorded in here, I believe, was in late April. And over the course of that, what I believe, 4.5 months or something along those lines, close to 5 months, a lot has gone on in politics. So let me start off with a couple of other retirements. One in the United States Senate that happened on May the 1st, Senator Ben Cardin, the Democrat from Maryland, he is not running for re-election in 2024. It is, given how the primary is shaped up, it is going to be a battle between Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. That is a majority black suburbs of Washington, D.C. And you have Representative David Trone, who is representing the 6th District. That's Western Maryland and parts of Montgomery County. Right now, the favorite is Executive Alsobrooks. If Alsobrooks wins, she would be the first ever black senator from Maryland. So a lot of Democratic groups, especially I believe the Congressional Black Caucus, is trying to get Alsobrooks elected, if not outwardly, definitely behind the scenes, even if they will be working against one of their own colleagues and Representative David Trone. But that is how that primary is likely to go, a primary that we might not have as clear an indication of who the favorite is going to be the Washington governor's primary for the Democrats. Governor Jay Inslee, who is age 72, he is not running for re-election either in 2024. And this broke on the same day as Cardin's retirement. The former long-shot 2020 presidential candidate, three-term governor of Washington, is retiring at the end of this year. You have a couple of candidates that have come up. You have Attorney General Bob Ferguson. You have Commissioner of Public Lands Hillary France on the Democratic side. On the Republican side of things, you have Sammy Byrd, who's the chair of the Benton County GOP. That is I believe my geography in Washington isn't the greatest. I think it's in between Seattle and Tacoma. It's in that, you know, SeaTac area of counties. I think it might actually be west of Tacoma. If you're watching this, correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, it's been rumored that potentially former Representative Jamie Herrera Butler, who is on the more moderate side of the Republican Party, might try and have a crack at things and maybe try to force Democrats to compete in Washington. An interesting fact about Washington is that it has the longest streak of Democratic governance. The last time a GOP governor was elected in Washington was 1985. And Jay Inslee's political career started 4 years after that in 1989. So yes, Inslee's been around Washington politics for a very long time, but Washington has been governed by Democrats for an even longer stretch of time, and I don't think that's something that's going to change, especially with this being a presidential cycle. I'm not expecting like a 20-point partisan gap between the presidential governor's race that would have to occur for a Republican to even have a chance at winning in Washington. Then a week later, on May the 8th, you had it's the clown show that is occurring within the Alabama State Democratic Party. So in that meeting, the party leadership chaired by Randy Kelly and Joe Reed, the leader of the Alabama Democratic Caucus, which is a majority caucus in the state party. Senator Doug Jones, if you want to get an idea of how bad a lot of anti-Reedists say it is, Doug Jones described it as, quote, the death of the Democratic Party in Alabama. The SDEC, the State Democratic Executive Committee, voted to eliminate party-mandated caucuses. These are caucuses like the Youth Caucus, LGBTQ Plus Caucus, Disabled People's Caucus, and they also made rules that diminished the power of Latino, Asian American, Pacific Islander, and Native American caucuses in the party as well. Those caucuses are nationally mandated by the Democratic National Committee, and it's not the first time they've done this. They did this, I believe, back in like 2019 or so, when Reed and former Chair Nancy Worley and a couple of other people, Randy Kelly, I think, was there. I think Kelly had his and their Democratic Party credentials revoked, but they got them back. There was a new leader, Chris England, but then England stepped down. And then in the new elections, Randy Kelly, who is essentially a puppet of Joe Reed, he ended up winning. And since then, there has been a massive intra-party fighting, let's say. You have the College Democrats of Alabama, who their executive committee voted pretty much immediately afterwards to suspend ties with the Alabama Democratic Party. They're now currently chartered under the College Democrats of America, unaffiliated with the Alabama Democratic Party. That is something that is probably going to be a reoccurring theme in episodes like this, and something I wanted to bring attention to because of another story that will be about Alabama politics. And no, I'm not talking about the maps, although I will be covering that as well. But first, Donald Trump. I need to get this out of the way. The 91 federal charges that he's facing in 4 separate criminal cases, plus all the other civil cases that he's facing as he tries to get the presidency back. He's not the only politician who's facing federal charges. Not the only Republican politician from New York who's facing federal charges. Because the colorful character himself, Representative George Santos, on May the 10th, he surrendered to federal authorities in Long Island. He faced counts of wire fraud, money laundering, false statements to the U.S. House of Representatives, of which he is a member. And of course, there was one count of theft of public funds as well. Now, there is a history of, you know, Republican representatives, especially recently Republican representatives, you know, retiring and resigning because of, you know, criminal charges levied against them. You had Duncan Hunter of California, Chris Collins of New York had resigned. Now, Santos has not resigned yet as of the recording of this podcast, but should he resign, it would trigger a special election, and that is something that I don't think Kevin McCarthy wants, because Biden won the district, New York's 3rd congressional district, by over 8 percentage points. That district contains, it's mostly in Nassau County and contains parts of Queens. And even though George Santos won by 8 points in 2022, that's probably largely a, you know, figure of the New York State Democratic Party forgetting to campaign in 2022. That is also something I will be discussing in future episodes. It's just another headache for Speaker Kevin McCarthy in a list of headaches that he does not want. I'll be getting to some of them later on. Now, of course, there were a few elections that happened. I'm going through this chronologically. So May 16th, you had, well, let's just talk about Kentucky for a second. That'll be one of the races that we will be focusing on in the fall 2023 semester. You have Andy Beshear, the governor of Kentucky, versus, and he's a Democrat, by the way. He narrowly beat GOP Governor Matt Bevin in 2019. Beshear will be facing off against Republican Attorney General Daniel Cameron. Now, Beshear, he comes from a political family in Kentucky with a lot of lineage. Steve Beshear was the former governor of Kentucky. Steve is Andy's father. And so you have the Beshear name is very popular in Kentucky. Andy Beshear himself is a popular governor in Kentucky and has been leading pretty much all the polls in Kentucky. I mean, people might find it shocking, you know, oh, it's a Trump by 25 state, a Trump by 26 state. How can a Democrat be leading in Kentucky? Oh, it's a long political history that I'm not going to get into. All I'll say as for the modern day is that in 2022, I believe, there was an abortion referendum in Kentucky where the anti-abortion side lost by about 5 points. I'll be discussing in more detail later. But that's one of the elections we probably need to be wary of as we get into the November 2023 election cycles, which obviously will be a lot more localized than what we'll be seeing next year. Of course, you have a governor's race in Louisiana. The Democratic conservative governor, John Bel Edwards, is term limited. Republicans see that as essentially an auto flip for their party. And you have a governor's race in Mississippi. Democrats have a long shot chance to potentially shock the world and flip the race. You have an unpopular Republican governor in Tate Reeves, a pretty popular Democratic, you know, public service commissioner in Brandon Presley. And yes, he is related to Elvis. I did check. And such Democrats may be thinking, you know, we might have a bit of an opportunity in the most racially polarized state in the union, that is Mississippi. One candidate that doesn't have an opportunity to do anything except embarrass himself is Ron DeSantis. It was in late May where he announced his candidacy on Twitter. Oh, wait, it's X now? Huh. It's another thing that happened over the summer. But Ron DeSantis, like the former Bird app, has completely crashed and burned over the summer by a host of poor decisions and Ron DeSantis's inability to be social worth his life. For God's sakes, this has been the most embarrassing presidential campaign I have seen. I know I'm only 19, about to be 20 years old. I haven't seen much of anything in politics, but good Lord, it's going to take a lot to top this. Remember back in like December when Ron DeSantis was tied with Donald Trump and people were talking about him as the future of the Republican Party? Now he's struggling to beat Vivek Ramaswamy in the polls as of mid-September 2023. Back in December, people had no idea who a Vivek Ramaswamy even was. So that should tell you how far the governor of Florida has fallen. His presidential campaign kind of went like his announcement on Twitter. Oh, well, formerly Twitter. Elon, of course, changed the name to X later on. And yeah, it was a complete disaster. The campaign's been a complete disaster. Ron DeSantis' campaign is now saying that a strong second place showing in Iowa would be acceptable for them, which, honestly, just give it up, Ron. Give it up and drop out. Save yourself in dignity because you are not winning this race. I will explain a bit more into his debate performance in Milwaukee a few weeks ago in the second episode. So just hold your horses for that. Now, of course, in late May, there was also something about the debt limit and that, you know, Republican conservatives and hardline conservatives, especially from the House Freedom Caucus, were wanting just a stop to all additional spending. And then you had progressive Democrats on the other side that didn't want Joe Biden to reach a deal with Kevin McCarthy at all. It was essentially a giant mess. Essentially, what the deal between Joe Biden and Kevin McCarthy, what they agreed to was to not have the debt limit be breached until quarter one of 2025, so after the presidential election, which I see as a pretty major win for Joe Biden, because that's not something the Republicans can immediately beat Democrats over the head with as you head into a what is expected to be a very competitive 2024 cycle. And, you know, you had Chip Roy, had other people like Ralph Norman say, oh, well, Kevin McCarthy's breaching the contract, which is something Matt Gaetz alluded to, and essentially threatening to try and get Kevin McCarthy out of the speakership, which congressional dysfunction is something that will also be covered in whatever news flashes we do over the course of a week. So there is that to go as well. And people will talk about motions to vacate, yada, yada, yada. And it was all a giant mess. And Congress is still a giant mess because there's a rule on the defense bill that the Republican leadership doesn't think can get passed because they don't think the Democrats are going to save them. Which, speaking of, by the way, the rule on the debt limit compromise, which essentially it's a rules package is what it is. It's just congressional jargon. It's something that has to be passed before you can have a full vote on the bill itself. And you had about like 40 or so Republicans that voted against the rules package, which would in a very tightly divided House as it is right now, that would send the debt limit compromise to its death unless Kevin McCarthy reached out to Democrats and essentially begged on his knees for their votes, and he ended up getting them. I think it may have been about 20 Republicans who voted against the rule, and you had like 40 Democrats voting for it or something like that. I don't know, but he essentially, I think there was some deal on earmarks that had to be agreed to with House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York, but it was all a giant mess, and that goes into the second giant mess that we'll be covering. Or is it the third, since we've already talked about Ron DeSantis? Yeah, it's the third. And that goes into Allen versus Milligan. It's something I've posted a lot about on the Pulse of the Nation Instagram account. It's PulsePodcast_UA. And that was a ruling that was widely expected to favor the Republicans. Essentially, it's a challenge over the congressional map in Alabama, which, you know, is racially gerrymandered. Of course, the black population in Alabama is large enough and compact enough to support two black majority or two black opportunity districts. What the state legislature has done is have only one of them that stretches from Birmingham to Tuscaloosa to Selma to Montgomery. That is where Terry Sewell represents. That is UA's congressional district, the 7th. And it's likely to still be the 7th, but it was a 5-4 ruling. You had the three liberals on the case, as well as conservatives John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh, to join in essentially saying that Alabama's congressional map was racially gerrymandered and that they had to redraw the maps to accommodate a second black opportunity district. Now, did the Alabama Republican-controlled state legislature do that? You already know the answer. Of course they didn't. They did not. They barely even tried to have a black opportunity district. The district that they ended up drawing, I think, was about shrunk by 10 or something like that. It's something that in a racially polarized state like we have here in Alabama, especially considering our sordid racial history and racist history, especially even going back to when our state was founded in 1819. It's something that was just seen as a slap in the face, not just to black voters, but the Supreme Court itself, essentially continuing the mass resistance that was pretty famous back in the 1950s and 1960s when racists did not want schools to be integrated. And essentially, I wrote an analysis that essentially called it cope from the Alabama GOP. They're trying to do everything they can to save their own congressional seat because they don't want to be responsible for drawing out one of Jerry Call or Barry Moore. Jerry Call represents Mobile Baldwin counties. Barry Moore represents Southeast Alabama. And so inevitably, one of them was going to have to be drawn. is going to have to be either drawn out, they'll be put an incumbent on incumbent primary. The Alabama GOP didn't want to do that. They've been trying to kick the can down the road. They've essentially been getting laughed out of court the past 3 months. I think yesterday or a couple of days ago was the latest round of getting laughed out of court. They appealed to the Supreme Court to essentially try to get them to reverse their own ruling. And Allen versus Milligan trying to get Brett Kavanaugh on side to what the Alabama GOP wants, but it's something that is likely to warrant a second black majority congressional district. If it does, I will then discuss who could be the potential candidates for that congressional district. But we're going to move on to another thing that happened in Alabama, and that is the city of Mobile. It became the second largest city in Alabama after, you know, some areas, essentially in Cottage Hill and Kings Branch and Orchard Creek, they voted to annex themselves to the city of Mobile. But it was a fourth area in the Airport Boulevard area that rejected annexation. But yeah, because of this, there is now a new second largest city in Alabama. It is Mobile. It has surpassed Birmingham. It has surpassed Montgomery to become the second largest city. Mayor Sandy Simpson was overjoyed at this referendum result. Of course, now Huntsville is the largest city in Alabama and will be for a while. Birmingham and Montgomery are under 200,000. And now the city of Mobile, it grew because of the annexation votes to about 20,000 people to now it's just under 205,000 people. So there was some conversation about, you know, potentially concerns about the reduction of black voter power in the city because Mobile is and still is a majority black city, I believe, with the annexation vote. But these annexed areas were more, you know, more majority white. And there was this whole conversation. There was a Jacobin article that was written about this whole situation. It's something that was very interesting. But we go to national politics now, and something that I've been keeping my eyes on for a bit is that there's an open governor's race in New Hampshire. Governor Chris Sununu, he's a popular, moderate-ish Republican governor. He decided he is not running for re-election in 2024 or election for any race. He was speculated to be a presidential candidate. He decided to not go for anything. And this could be disastrous for New Hampshire Republicans, and I'll tell you why. Because they don't have that big of a majority in the 400-member state house, which, let's be honest, is completely ridiculous that a state as small as New Hampshire has 400 house members that they're barely paying, for the love of God. Their state senate's a lot smaller. It's something that's a bit more solid for the Republican Party. But considering that New Hampshire is trending to the left at a pretty quick clip on the federal level, and you have probably Joyce Craig, who's the mayor of Manchester in southern New Hampshire, she's probably going to get the nomination. There has been a few Republicans who might want to run. I think State Senate President Chuck Morse is running. Kelly Ayotte, the former U.S. Senator who narrowly lost re-election in 2016 to current Senator Maggie Hassan, she's also running as well. Now, the interesting thing is that this primary will happen a year from now, in September 2024, and that is when people will already be starting to cast their votes for president in North Carolina. And that's just like the really, really early votes that will be coming in. But yeah, going to be a very competitive governor's race in New Hampshire. Democrats are thinking about maybe they could get a statewide trifecta in New Hampshire, which would be a very sudden change from the GOP trifecta that is occurring right now in the state of New Hampshire. It's one of those like New England states that is a lot more amenable to Republicans down ballot historically. States like Connecticut, states like Massachusetts have elected Republican governors or came very close to electing Republican governors recently, although that is starting to die out. Vermont is one of the bluest, most liberal states in the union, and it has a Republican governor, albeit Phil Scott did vote for Joe Biden in 2020, so how Republican is he truly? How representative is he of the Republican Party? Probably not much, but there is still a very competitive governor's election in New Hampshire. Going back to Alabama, now a bit more of a national story that broke at the end of July, is that Biden administration decided he was going to keep Space Command in Colorado, in Colorado Springs, even though it was, I think it was a GBO report that or GAO, Government Accountability Office assessment. It was an assessment of potential Space Command locations. It said that Huntsville was the best. I mean, you have like the U.S. Space Center, you have Redstone Arsenal. Huntsville is a very space-centered city. It's where they hold Space Camp. I went there when I was in middle school. It was a very fun experience. And essentially what happened was that Air Force officials wanted to move it to Huntsville, but the head of Space Command, General James Dickinson, wanted to stay in Colorado. There was accusations of national politics being a factor in the decision, particularly abortion politics. Colorado has very liberal abortion laws, and Alabama, well, doesn't. So there were accusations by Republicans, oh, we're being punished for being pro-life, yada, yada, yada. It's yada. The official, you know, decision-making process that the White House put out doesn't mention abortion politics. Although, let's be honest, that has to be a consideration, considering, you know, the closest abortion provider you can get from Huntsville is probably going to be somewhere in Roanoke, Virginia, or maybe in Illinois, because the South as a whole has passed very strict abortion laws. There was North Carolina, but you had a Democratic state representative switch to the Republican Party over school choice, and essentially her feelings were hurt. This is Tricia Cotham that I'm talking about, but it really got North Carolina Democrats angry because that tipped it to where the GOP has a supermajority in the state legislature and can basically pass anything they want, no override vetoes and stuff like that. Because there is a Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, who is term limited. He's not running for re-election, and that's going to be one of the most competitive governor's races. I will get more to that in future episodes. That episode is not today or this weekend. Now, some more somber news did happen in New Jersey politics. The first black statewide elected official, Sheila Oliver, she was the lieutenant governor of New Jersey. She passed away over the summer at age 71. I believe it was a more of a sudden health condition. The day before, Governor Phil Murphy's office said she was receiving medical care for an undisclosed condition, and that condition seemed to deteriorate rapidly. Once again, our thoughts are with the family of Lieutenant Governor Oliver as they continue to deal with the loss. Speaking of losses, let me focus on the election interference case more, the one that's being brought up by Special Counsel Jack Smith. This is a federal case. It's not the Fannie Willis case. I'll get to that in a minute. But let me explain the election interference case some more. So essentially, there's four criminal charges related to his attempts to overturn the results of the election in 2020. Of course, Donald Trump lost, which is something that a majority of the Republican Party can't really seem to get their heads around. There is one count for conspiracy to defraud the United States, one for conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding. That official proceeding would be, you know, the Electoral College votes coming into the House and being read, yada, yada, yada. You have obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and there's conspiracy against rights, i.e. the charge by Jack Smith is that and the Department of Justice, that voting rights, the right to vote, and the vote to be counted in states like Georgia, Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, they even tried it in New Mexico, was that those voters' rights were, it was a conspiracy to take those rights away and put true voter power in the hands of, you know, unelected electors, so to speak. There were six unnamed co-defendants. There's attorneys, political consultants, there was even a former official at the Department of Justice during the Trump administration. That was an unindicted co-conspirator. And, of course, there was another one that came around. But before that, you had more elections. Yes, there were Tennessee elections on August 3rd last month. And essentially, Nashville had the first round of mayoral elections that month. He had a few special elections that were going around. So let me just go into the Nashville results, where it was essentially a big win for progressive forces in Nashville. Like, you have, you know, the backlash to trans rights, and also, you know, also the Titan Stadium is a really big local issue. There's also housing being very expensive in the Nashville area and in the city of Nashville. And you had a progressive Metro Council member, which is essentially city council for Nashville. Nashville and Davidson County are pretty much one and the same, where you had an incumbent by the name of John Cooper. The Cooper family is pretty big in Nashville politics. John Cooper, he did not run for re-election. And you had a progressive by the name of Freddie O'Connell. He got first place in the primary. He was the main left-wing candidate. He got over 27%. The closest other candidate you had, GOP strategist Alice Rowley. She also advanced to the runoff, and that is something that is pretty much seen as a foregone conclusion for Freddie O'Connell to win. And progressives knocked off the vice mayor of Nashville. You had a couple of moderates and liberals like Matthew Wiltshire, Jeff Yarbrough in the race, but they got third and fourth respectively. And you had another victory for progressives in House District 51, which is in Tennessee. This was brought on by one state representative had suddenly passed away, and there was an appointed incumbent to that district, and he was defeated by a left-wing activist who had the backing of Middle Tennessee DSA, Afton Bain. She won by about 7 or so points there. And you had a couple of other special elections. You had two of the Tennessee three, the two that were expelled, Justin Jones and Justin Pearson, easily won their re-election bids. And it's as easy as eating a bowl of cereal, and it was even easier than that for both Jones and Pearson. You had another special election in the third district of the third House district of Tennessee, that's East Tennessee. And you had that. There was a big Democratic outperformance. And that is something I'll be covering in future episodes as well. Something that I've been noticing over the summer. Democrats continuing to overperform in special elections and have really good special election results. Now, by themselves, they don't mean anything, but together they represent a trend. And I'll explain more as we go on into the season. Now, let me talk about the Georgia case. That's one of the biggest things that has happened in politics in 2023. Donald Trump and 18 other people were indicted in this aversion case. Essentially, this is Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis indicted Mr. Trump, as well as you had Mark Meadows, Rudy Giuliani, Jeffrey Clark, Sidney Powell, John Eastman, yada, yada, yada. And they're charged with a variation of crimes. All of them were charged with RICO, violating the RICO statute, which is essentially racketeering, and basically it's basically in Georgia, it's a lot more liberal use of RICO than in other states. It's any conspiracy to commit a crime in their acts that is charged under RICO in Georgia. It's the same statute that is being used against the COP City activists in Atlanta. That is a state prosecution by the state attorney general in that case. Donald Trump himself was charged on 12 other counts besides RICO. You had conspiracy to make false statements, solicitation of violation of oath of public officer, first degree conspiracy to commit forgery, yada, yada, yada. And there were breaches into voting machines in Coffee County, which is a rural county in South Georgia, gave Trump 70% of the vote. And they all got mugshots. This is the major thing. Like, Georgia has very anti-defendant criminal justice laws to where, like, you will get a mugshot. It will be released no matter who you are. And, you know, the pardoning thing is also very anti-defendant. You have to be, like, out of jail for 5 years and on good behavior. And only then can you submit your case to, you know, the parole board. Or I think it's like a pardon board or something like that. But yeah, you had it 9 days after the charges were announced. We got a very historic picture. I'm sure you've all seen it. You've seen the mugshot picture. I posted it on the on our Instagram account. And it was quite a surreal day when, you know, it was very quick proceedings because he is the former president. But to have a former president of the United States, and not only that, to have a presumptive party nominee for president of the United States have a mugshot for an active case coming against them is something that is very, very, very surreal. And what I said in the Instagram post is that he didn't get 11,780 votes, as he was asking from Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. That's one of the charges, for what it's worth. And he got 13 additional criminal charges and a mugshot instead. Now, what was really interesting about the mugshot thing is that this was actually leaked on the former Byrd app, now called X. And you had a couple of Twitter accounts that had gotten the mugshot before it was released. It did not contain the Fulton County Sheriff's Office watermark, which we still don't know how that got leaked, but it did end up getting leaked regardless. It's something that we'll probably find more about in the coming months, but that's something that's going to be on the side burner for now. District Attorney Fani Willis really wants a very speedy trial for all of these. Essentially, what is expected is that this case is going to come first for the four for Donald Trump, and we'll move along as we go along. However, one state representative that is not going along with his job is David Cole, because he's no longer a state representative, because he resigned, because he turns out he committed voter fraud. So essentially, you have this Alabama state representative. He's a Republican for Madison in House District 10. David Cole was arrested and booked in the county jail, and this was back in late August. The charge was voter fraud, specifically of voting at multiple or unauthorized locations. Essentially, so he represents House District 10, but he actually lives in House District 4, the next district over. And he was voting in House District 10, which isn't where he lives. That's voter fraud, and you go to jail for it. Now, David Cole took a plea deal in which he had to resign from the House of Representatives. There is no word on whether there will be a special election here, but if it is, I suspect it will be highly competitive. Why is that? Because House District 10 is essentially contains parts of Madison and southern parts of Huntsville. It's a district Donald Trump won by less than a point in 2020. It's a district that Joe Biden is all but certain, in my opinion, going to win in 2020, and depending on who is nominated there, depending on if a special election is even called, it could be something to watch, especially with the trend over the summer and even before the summer of Democrats having really good special election performances, especially in a district where abortion politics, Dobbs, and stuff like that is going to matter, especially in a district where the far-right Moms for Liberty group has been starting to organize, especially in areas like Madison. They try to have an event, but the library in Madison, Alabama, just couldn't hold them. So they had to get kicked out. They sued to be forced in, but that was essentially just, they got told, lol, you're not going to be forced in. And that's something that's also happening, plus with the recent events surrounding the Alabama Library and potential book bans coming as well. That's something that could be very prevalent in a suburban district like House District 10, which is Southern Madison County. And that's something that we're going to be watching, especially as it could be one of those portends of future, you know, national implications, potentially. We also had another special election. I'm going to end this off on another special election. Yes, I know, but, you know, just yesterday at the time of recording, you had a special election in New York and an assembly district that is in Queens, and it's very interesting. Like, I know some of UA students do come from New York City, the New York City area. Some come from Nassau County, that sort of stuff. So essentially, the district has two parts. You have Whitestone and College Point, two areas that are leaning towards Republicans at this point in time. And then you have down south, you have Kew Gardens Hills, which is a heavily Orthodox Jewish community. And then you have Electchester, which is essentially a union co-op built by union electricians, yada, yada, yada. It's one of the most interesting assembly districts, state legislative districts that the United States has, and yet a special election, both candidates, Democrat and Republican, were Orthodox Jews. You had Sam Berger and David Hirsch. David Hirsch is a rabbi, and Sam Berger is He comes from a, I believe, a political family, and he got the endorsement from the, believe it was the Jewish Weekly or something like that. And a lot of the rabbis in the local area, particularly in Kew Gardens Hills. And so even though it voted for Lee Zeldin by 14 points, voted for Biden by 13 points, Sandberger ended up winning it by 11 or so. So congratulations, Republicans. You outperformed Donald Trump in a special election for the first time since May. But it's one of those shallow, small overperformances that really isn't going to do much to the national average. And this does show the power of the Orthodox Jewish voting bloc in a localized area, because it's very interesting, you know, that the Orthodox community is essentially, it does act like a bloc. Essentially, the best or quickest way I can say it is that the rabbis, the leaders of the synagogues, will endorse a candidate, and then the voters will vote for that candidate. Like they endorsed Lee Zeldin, and he got amazing margins. They endorsed Hillary Clinton in 2016 before going to Donald Trump in 2020 over the fact that Donald Trump put the U.S. embassy in Israel in Jerusalem, which the Israeli-Palestinian issue has also become more of a hot topic in party politics because of the influence of AIPAC, which is something I'll be talking about in future episodes. But that is where I'm going to end it here. I've been talking for long enough. I'm going to be talking more tomorrow. And I'm sure you heard enough of me already. So thank you for watching Season 2, Episode 1 of Pulse of the Nation. We will be back tomorrow, and I will essentially be grading how all the Republican candidates did at the first debate in Milwaukee. I'll see you there, and have a good day.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.